Are you listening? Damn.
And welcome back once again to the Endurance Hour podcast. This is episode 354. Back alongside Wendy Mader, I'm Dave Erickson. Got a lot of questions to go over today. A couple of them from the T2 Endurance group. Got some people who are interested in joining that group as well. Wendy, last time we talked, you had just finished up an epic, it was a 23-hour limit on the trail run. It was a 74 miles or so.
Yes, the Georgia Death Race, 25-hour time limit, and I finished in 20 hours.
So that was like 3 weeks ago. So a lot's happened since you and I have reconnected. Have I missed anything since? Have you done any more epic races or events?
I haven't done anything epic. You know, I did take a week and I went to Colorado. And so that was a long overdue actual vacation for me. I did, you know, did some training, went to some old trails that I used to run, hike, not really being a trail runner back then. So it was fun to go back and do some local trails, see a lot of my friends, and just kind of had some me time. You know, it was really, there was no event. It wasn't a training trip. It was just a vacation. It was really nice.
And when will you start ramping up your training for some of your A and B races, triathlon related this year?
June. You know, even when I lived in Colorado and living in Georgia, I usually get out on my bike once it hits June. It's summertime. It's consistently warm weather. I have the schedule. And I have been out on my bike. I actually got outside on my road bike last week, which was really nice. But generally, I wait until June, again, because I'll be consistently riding outside. Mm-hmm. And that's when I guess I'm going to say I'm going to be ramping up some sort of plan to get ready for some races. Ultimate goal is Kona in October. So I'm not really sure what I'm doing in between, except for some local. I have a 10K and a half marathon planned. As far as triathlon goes, I'm not quite sure yet. So those will just be pieced in as needed, as I'm feeling motivated, as I can, because I do have a lot of swim meets that I coach on the weekends. So training and racing on the weekends is usually pretty limited for me.
It's going to be very exciting here in a week or so when they do their first ever Ironman World Championship in St. George, which is a matter of less than a month. And that combination of people, is it over 2 days? I can't remember because I was signed up. People can
I think it's 1 day.
It's 1 day, but you can participate as the St. George athlete or the World Championship athlete. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Which is strange to say, hey, we're all in this, but when you finish, it only counts toward the St. George, which what everyone naturally or originally signed up for, but then they melded it together like, okay, we're moving it over here. Inland.
Well, again, I can't remember. We talked about this before, but it's been a while. If you were registered for the St. George Ironman, then you have a chance to qualify for the 2022 Ironman in Kona. If you're registered for the St. George 2021 World Championships, can you still qualify for the 2022 World Championships? I can't remember what we figured that out.
Because I signed up for the original St. George Ironman, they said you can transfer your entry, which I ended up doing, or you can do the race as an Ironman World Championship. Like I think all your race bib numbers and things would be classified as that.
So everyone in St. George, no matter where, no matter how you registered for it or when you registered for it, everyone in St. George is part of the 2021 Ironman World Championship.
I think that's correct.
Okay.
But the people who qualified originally for Kona are racing their World Championship in St. George.
Right.
Whereas the people who signed up for St. George are now racing as the Ironman World Championship, or they can transfer out, which I did.
Got it. Okay.
Because I didn't feel like, I don't want to have all that swag that says, you know, world championship athlete, at least qualifier. Nah, not necessarily. Plus,
it
gave me more time to do what I want to do, which is, you know, which I would prefer to do, and that's Arizona. So that's what
good.
Interesting. So yeah, that's coming up big time, and I'm sure we'll talk about that ramp up and how challenging that will be once the race is over. And good stuff. And there was Ironman Texas that just finished up a weekend ago.
Oh, yeah, that was brutal.
Well, I saw a former guest on the podcast, friendly person of mine over the years, Ben Hoffman winning the race under 8 hours. That was exciting to see. And I think someone behind him was also very close. It was a very close second finish.
Yeah, I mean, there were great performances, but for I think a lot of the age groupers that I personally knew and I personally coached, it was a brutal, windy, extremely windy day. And again, to me, I try to prepare for every race that there's going to be wind, heat, and hills. And when I'm training in the wind, heat, and hills, and I'm struggling, I just tell myself I have to become the expert at riding in wind, heat, and hills, because that just seems to be, even on a flat course, you seem to get some wind, some heat, and some hills. And so you just got to, you know, train for it. And when you get it race day, you're a little bit more prepared as best you can be.
Yeah. Well, that was the most recent one that I'm aware of. And there's also, what, have we talked since Oceanside? I don't remember if we've talked since Oceanside on that epic finish. Lionel Sanders, and I can't remember the other guy who finished ahead of him, but they were neck and neck. It was more.
I saw the finish. Yeah. We don't think we talked about that. That was early April.
Maybe not. And one topic of discussion that came up was there is no official line on the ground where you cross that's official. They always just put a tape up, and whoever hits the tape first is considered the winner, which they had a, not a controversy, but years back in Boise, a couple of Boise finishes actually in the past. There was a Chris Lieto, Craig Alexander in the before 2008. And then there was one even after that in which I participated because Melissa, my wife, was filming that day for me and caught the finish. And that was that actually our video was used to try to determine the winner because used it in slow motion. And that was one of the great shots of who won that one. But there's no official like line on the ground or sensor on the ground that I'm aware of. And that was a topic. Have you heard anything about that? And what's your stance on how do we, it's not very often we have these finishes anyways in triathlon.
Well, it's an interesting thing because I've never thought about it. I just think there's a timing chip, and I'm under the impression that once your timing chip crosses this imaginary line, that's your finish time. Never really thought if the line was imaginary or if it was real, because when I'm crossing the finish line, I got my arms up with a smile and I'm looking for a good photo finish. I'm not looking at the imaginary finish line. So no, I haven't really thought about it.
Well, because they have the mark, they have the sensors taped on the ground. Everyone sees those over black tape. But I don't know where they are necessarily right underneath the banner. Maybe they are a couple steps prior to the banner.
I think they're a couple steps prior to the banner.
Yeah. I mean, for logistics purposes, like, hey, here's a timing mat. There it is. But when it comes to the professionals and them having to win, I don't know how many age group championship races have been determined by a sprint finish. I don't know of any, but we've certainly seen a couple of these professionals do it. And it was in the Olympics not too long ago as well, where a couple of the women came down to a photo finish. And I don't know if it was a photo or if it was the sensors in the ground. I think it was a photo. They were determining who crossed.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know. Just now it comes to mind. And back to mind is the podcast, which is already in progress here. So inside the T2 Endurance Group on Facebook, we've got five different people who have requested to join, but we also have some really good discussions there. And since we haven't been on the call for a few, Wendy has been active sharing some videos and some topics. One of those is about mistakes we've all made in the past, whether it's how to maintain our bodies, training mistakes, or racing mistakes. So what was your motivation on sharing this, and what was your hopes of getting out of this this posting?
Well, during 2020, when things were shut down, I created a lot of videos, and we uploaded them. You edited them, and then we uploaded them into YouTube. And I posted them, a lot of them, most of them, back in 2020. But since then, you know, we've had so many more new members. And because people weren't really actively participating in their sport, as in race preparation, maybe people didn't even see the videos I posted back then. So I decided it's April, it's people's preseason, they're getting ready for BNC races. And I started posting some race preparation stuff, a lot of stuff on wetsuits, because 'tis the season that people are going to be venturing out in open water. And I go back and look at these videos. I'm like, oh, we did a pretty good job. I'm going to repost these because they're really good videos. So the one I recently posted were 10 mistakes athletes make. And I think, you know, mistakes that I learned, I probably made within the first 10 years, and I've been training for 30 years. I've learned from my past mistakes, and I just put together a list of my past 10 mistakes, and I wanted to see people in the group if they could relate or if they could share, because, you know, the group is a community based and we all like to learn from each other. And I, you know, again, I look back at that video, I'm like, this is a really good video.
Katie replied to this video in the comment section below, and she was saying that I never did any kind of exercises with my job until I started doing triathlon, and she's a mail carrier, and she's been a mail carrier for many, many years and would walk between 6 and 10 miles a day, 5 days a week, which is great. And then she started triathlon in 2015. Her mistakes and tries that she never thought weight and core work really mattered, and did it half-heartedly. So she recently had surgery for a torn meniscus, and so the weight and core work really have become important for her. She says, how often do you recommend visits to the PT or chiropractor and massage, and how often do you do weights and core each week?
Yeah, so I'm really glad she asked the question, just to start some conversation and get some chatter going on. So two of those topics were in my top 10 list. One is, for me, not recognizing the importance of strength and mobility. And again, I overcame this back in 2010. And the other another one, I think it was my final number 10, was not seeking out massage or chiropractic or physical therapy when I was injured. Again, I started back in 1992, and I, you know, there's really not a lot of information out there. And I was a graduate teaching assistant, so I was a student. I didn't have a lot of money, so I never really went to the doctors. It was never really on my mind that I was injured and maybe I should seek professional help and get a professional diagnosis. So as a coach now, I see, you know, athletes that I coach will get injured, and the first thing I say is, you got to go get a diagnosis so you can treat the injury and not just do a Google search and think you have something going on based on the description that you read. You actually, it's worth the money going to someone who you trust, who's going to tell you what you have, and then they can help you, guide you in the right direction to treat the injury. And so she had asked those two questions. And my comment back is, number one, how often should you go to a massage or chiropractor? I would ask them, you know, because they know what they're treating on you, and they know what your injury is, and they're going to give you the best advice of how often you should see them. Me, I'm not a massage person. I actually did find a good massage therapist about 2 months ago, but I'm still not a regular massage person. But I do have a really good chiropractor, and I only started using chiropractors in 2017. Before that, I wasn't interested in chiropractors, but I found some good ones that understand me, understand how my body works, and I understand what they're doing to me. And so for me personally, because I've had so many pre-existing injuries dating back 1997, I know when I'm feeling an injury coming on. I know, like, if my left hip is achy, or my hip flexor's tight, or my calf starts to bother me, I know I need to back off training and I need to go get an adjustment. And so that's how I determine when I go. And my chiropractors, I've actually seen two, are in agreement with me. They don't want to see me every week. They tell me, you know, how, you know, kind of when I should see them, but they totally always leave it up to me because they know that I'm pretty mindful of how I'm feeling and when I need an adjustment. And so I would definitely ask your therapist. And then regarding, like, the core strength training, I've been doing it since 2010. The times that I've neglected it is the times where I start to feel an injury coming on. And so that reminds me that I can't skip my little basic 20-minute, you know, hip core mobility stability program, because it keeps me healthy.
It sure isn't sexy, and I think that might be the turnoff for some people. It's like, oh, I don't want to sit here. It doesn't feel like I'm doing anything productive actively. And
right.
I'm guilty of it too. It's like, do I really want to stretch right now? I just got done with a bike workout. That's when I'm most ready to stretch further than I have been when I'm cold. So, yeah, I got to do that. And how can I make this time go by? Well, maybe I'll listen to something, or maybe I'll watch something, and that helps.
Yeah.
And I always feel good afterwards, but it's like it's like pulling teeth just to go and stretch a little bit, because it feels like I'd rather bike, run, or swim. That's what I want to do. because that's what I'm doing. But I know the back of my head, I'm not young forever. I need to do these other things because it all works together.
Yeah, and I think that's important. If you want to continue to enjoy running, biking, swimming for the longevity, you should do some sort of core mobility, strength training, something to keep you healthy, keep you mobile, get you stronger so you can, you know, advance in your sport. I just think it's important. And like I said, I know, you know, like, you know, I did my big race a month ago and I haven't really spent much time in the weight room. I haven't spent much time doing my core strength stuff. Mm-hmm. I just needed a little break. And now I'm approaching the next phase of the next season, the next phase of my training, and I'm ready and motivated and excited to get back to it.
On a related note, this is from Heidi, who's following our Couch to Ironman plan, which she got on Training Peaks. She says, Wendy, I'm trying to figure out strength training exercises to do, but I think I'm missing something. I thought I'd check out all your resources, but can't figure out some of the exercises. Do you happen to have any videos that walk me through the phase one strength training exercises? I was able to Google YouTube search, but they're not all there. What direction can you point Heidi in?
Right. So this is a good question. So when we have most of our programs on Training Peaks, all of them do include a strength component. And we do offer like a sample, you know, you're in this phase, these are the recommended exercises. I don't go too in depth with strength training because it is a personal thing. I don't want to recommend that you have to do a barbell squat and you don't have access to one. Or I don't want to recommend that you use a stability ball when you don't even have access to it. So I kept the strength training very general, but within the program, I do highlight a lot of resources, credible resources regarding strength training. And I do detail, you know, for these first 8 weeks, you're in the stability. The next 8 weeks, you're kind of moving into the strength, actual maximum strength phase. And then that third phase, you're moving into more of the maintenance phase, which is a little bit like the stability mobility phase one. And then I do offer like kind of a sample program. And since we've created a lot of these programs, you, Dave, who I referred her to, your YouTube channel, you actually demonstrate on YouTube how to perform all the exercises that we recommend in our training program. So I referenced that and kind of referred her to the channel to look up that program.
And also on that same YouTube channel, you just type in Endurance Hour on YouTube, you'll find that the channel that you subscribe to it. We have the four phases of strength training with Coach Wendy Mader. That's the title of the video. And in that, this is going to help answer Katie's question about strength training phases that Wendy shared within the T2 Endurance group. So there's multiple ways to answer this question. That's why we've made multiple videos on it, and it's all right there. We've got over 2,000 videos, so odds are if you use the right keywords, you should be able to find, I hope, what you're looking for. If not, let us know, and we can produce a video for you.
Yeah, and I actually, you have a, I just lost a word for it. You have a playlist.
Yes.
And in your playlist, I was able to find the playlist that would probably help her the most, and I sent her the link to the playlist.
Okay.
And ultimately, you know, when it comes to strength training, the most important thing is you execute the movements correctly. And so I always recommend if you don't know how to do something, skip it, or, you know, make a personal trainer appointment if you do these at a health club, or hire someone and spend an hour or two with someone to make sure that you're executing the movements correctly. When in doubt, take it out. And there's multiple ways to target your chest. There's multiple ways to target your back. Find something that you know how to do, and it's just keep it basic. And number two, it's just besides execution, you need to find and do something. You just need to do something that you enjoy and get into a habit of doing it. Once it's a habit, you're not going to want to skip it.
And to circle back to your chiropractor or massage, I've been doing that for a couple of years now where I have a standing appointment every 2 weeks for the combination of chiro and a sports massage. And they have been invaluable for me on injury prevention and catching things early and then working on them. There was a time last year, around this time of year, where I was really having some major knee pain. I was buying sleeves to put over my knee, trying to figure out why I couldn't run without pain. And so we did some cupping during some of the massage. I talked to the chiro about, is there something wrong with my gait, you know, adjusting my hips, and so on. and come to find out that I had some, you know, tearing in a, I think it was meniscus or some sort of inside of my knee was the issue. And it wasn't something else. It wasn't a tight IT band, or it wasn't something muscular. It was actually tearing from overuse and injury and age and so on. So because of that, on a regular basis of going to the therapist and such, I was able to go, all right, let's schedule an appointment with a specialist and find out what's going on. And since then, no issues with the knee. Had the surgery, which is a quick one-day turn. And, you know, 4 weeks later, I'm back running, and it's been the best thing. So I know there, you know, sometimes the insurance will have a nice little copay with it. If you can get that, if it's associated with your plan or whatever your current situation is, it's something to look into, because for longevity, as Wendy and I have been doing this for a long time, it can make a world of difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have quite a few. Let me double check on how many members we have. 695. Look at that. And we've got five requests for members into the T2 Endurance Group on Facebook. It's a private group, so we ask some questions before just to vet you out. And I'm going to approve a couple of them today. A couple of them did not answer questions, but I just want to, you know, verbally and publicly say welcome to RJ Youngblood. And she heard about us through Wendy, and she's looking into triathlon, and she has a Train Peaks account. What is a small background on RJ? She's not only going to be a new member, but she's also following a plan.
Yeah, she actually recently, within this past week, purchased our Couch to Sprint training plan made easy. I had followed up with her. You know, whenever anyone purchases a program from us and they leave their email, I'll always follow up with them. Thank you for purchasing. Ask them what kind of race they're training for. And then, you know, remind them that we have the T2 Endurance Facebook group. Remind them that we have the podcast and the Endurance Hour YouTube channel, because we're constantly creating new content for them that we don't necessarily, you know, I used to include new content in our plans, but that just becomes a little bit overwhelming and a lot of work to do. So I just tell people, for more content, more recent content, make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel.
This next young lady studies at the University of the Philippines, Diliman. I'm assuming that's in the Philippines. I looked at her profile, sent her a message because she received an email directing her to our link asking us to join the group. And she's interested in triathlon, and she too has a Train Peaks account. So she came back with an answer of like, she's a beginner. She's reading some articles online that assured her that the T2 Endurance Group would be a great place to help her reach her goal, which was a nice endorsement. She's done a sprint triathlon as in a relay form where she was a swimmer this month. She said she wasn't happy with her performance, and she's always wanted to participate in an Ironman. So she's looking for some credible sites or social groups that would help her reach her goals. So that's kind of cool. That's how she found us and why she's also a new member. And that's Denise. I'll leave the other ones alone because I've sent them messages to get a little more background on why they want to join us and so on. So welcome to more. That brings us to 697.
Cool. Well,
moving on to a few more questions here. This one from, let's go with, where's that one I want to talk about? Oh yeah. Sergio, he's training for Chattanooga 70.3. He asked this question: are nose clips allowed in triathlon events? Who would have thought whether they should be or should not be? What's your knowledge?
So I've actually done some private lessons with Sergio, and he's a complete really newbie. And so we've been working a lot about on balance and alignment. And with that, we're using fins, a snorkel. And when you wear a snorkel, it's really easier to wear a snorkel, I think, if you wear nose clips. So he's been practicing on his own with the nose clips, and he's finding that he's able to swim further with the snorkel and nose clips. So therefore he asked the question, and I had no idea. So I had to look it up. There's nothing in the rule book with USA Triathlon or World Triathlon Corporation events that you cannot wear a nose clip. I would assume, you know, people have allergies to chlorine that makes them wear a nose clip. People have allergies to the outdoors, something in the lake, whatever it is, that there's no harm in wearing a nose clip. And through the research, I was able to remind myself, with USA Triathlon, you are also allowed to wear a snorkel in a USA Triathlon event. You cannot wear one in a WTC sanctioned event.
Yeah, I was curious about this. I know one person who uses a nose clip, and it looks funny. You know, when I see them swing, it just looks funny. Plus, they sound funny when they try to talk to you in between sets. But I've never used one myself, and I don't know if it's just a matter of the rhythm and of breathing out your nose in your mouth, and I've never had an issue with it. Have you ever had an issue with it?
No. I'm so comfortable blowing out my nose underwater. I'm so comfortable breathing through my mouth that I don't wear nose clips. And when I see other people wearing snorkels, I hold my breath because I think they're holding their breath. And I'm like, oh, turn your head to breathe. But they don't need to because they're wearing a snorkel. And so I don't encourage athletes to wear nose clips because I think breathing and the ability to exhale out your nose and your mouth underwater before you inhale is such an important component to get comfortable in the water with breathing.
I found something on site about online about the disadvantages of nose clips. Breathing is less efficient because the nose is shut down and the overall physical efficiency in the water decreases. You are more inclined to hold your breath if you wear a nose plug. Holding your breath should be avoided, as it is better to exhale continuously in the water because it keeps the body more relaxed and the stroke more fluid. Water might become trapped in the nose and generate snot that can't be evacuated. Mm-hmm. And then, what's the other one here? When I started wearing one after a year, I had the problem that water entered my nose when I turned to breathe. Maybe this isn't a negative. Anyhow, they can be good for beginners, apparently, and can help you when you're crawling or do backstroke. But for us, I think it's important to not add it, because let's say you take that deep breath when you turn your head and then you go down, you can exhale through your nose a little bit or through your mouth. But it's one area, it's almost a safety. I need to have one more area in case I need to blow out or take a breath.
Right. And you also asked before we started the podcast about sighting. If you're, when you sight, again, we have great videos on the Endurance Hour YouTube channel about how to sight alligator eyes with me demonstrating. When you're sighting and you're in that balance point where you're looking up, you're exhaling at that time. You're exhaling out your mouth and nose. And then you continually turn your head to the side that you normally breathe on and take an inhale. And I think, especially with if you were wearing a snorkel, that would be just odd, because just lifting your head up with a snorkel on, you don't need to because you don't need to inhale. And I just think it would feel odd to lift your head up to sight. And I think you would lift your head up too much to sight, and that would cause your lower body to sink if you were wearing a nose plug. But I'll have to try it out and see.
I'm not interested in trying it out. I'm gonna skip it, stick to what I know at this point. Sean's got an interesting one. I got a little information behind his question here. He did his first outdoor bike ride in a while. Felt comfortable, he says. Felt confident. He's been able to put some power down, climb the hills. And then he says, here are his three learnings from his recent bike ride as an adult. Riding outdoors is such a blast. Number two, I consume a lot more water or liquid when riding outdoors versus indoors. And then long term, I may need a bigger chain ring. I ran out of gears twice and was spinning at 110 RPM and what felt like very little power output. I'm new to the bike component language, but I see the numbers 50-34T on the front chain ring, on the front row chain rings. So I assume that means 50 on the big and 34 on the small. Any suggestions if that makes sense to you, Wendy?
It does make sense to me. So you have, normally you have two. Some people have a compact crank that has three tooth chain rings in the front. And then on the back, you have what's called a cassette. Common cassette could be like 1125, where the smallest has 11 teeth on it and the biggest has 25. And then you have, 12, 13, 14, 15, 18, 20 in between. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're talking about. The chain rings in front, the cassette or the cogs are in back. So in the front, he has a 50 and a 34.
Yes.
Most what I've had in the past, I've never had a 50, is I usually have like a 54 in front. And I believe, I'm not even sure what that second one is, but it's, I'm more concerned with the 50. The 50 is the reason he's spinning out, and he's probably spinning out downhill, obviously, but maybe even a little bit on the flat. Mm-hmm. He's spinning out too much because he needs a bigger chain ring in front with more teeth, and it's going to require a different, he's probably going to have to get a new chain as well. Mm-hmm. And so he's able to apply more pressure while he's turning the crank.
Yeah. I don't know what my number is. In fact, my bike's in the shop right now, giving me a tune-up so I can prepare for the next 9 weeks. But yeah, I know what you mean. And people will change these things out based on the terrain of the course.
Yep.
Is a big factor. Whether you're climbing a lot and you need something smaller so you can spin higher and have less, it's not as hard to go. You have a little more wiggle room, kind of like mountain biking. Mountain bike is the best example, I think. You mountain bike, you can spin like crazy, go slow, but it's easier, and you can get up these steep climbs.
Yeah, so I usually change. I usually don't really pay much attention to the chain rings in front, but I know I usually have like a 52, 54, not a 56. A 56 is probably someone who's a lot taller than me and super tall. But in the back, when I'm like on a, like specifically for Florida, I changed my back cassette cogs out because I was riding a flat course. And I think I put on an 1123 or 1125 because I had an 1128 and I don't need, the 28 was useless because I had no hills to climb. When I did a race called, or an event called the Triple Bypass in Colorado, where we're climbing, you know, for 5, 6, 7, 8 miles over like Loveland Pass, Vail Pass, I got a different cassette on my back wheel up to a 34. So when I was changing gears on my back cassette, I could change it to the biggest gear was a 34 instead of a 28. And that made a huge difference climbing the long passes in Colorado.
And I'm just trying to look, do some research here, looking that it might be an 8. No, 11 is the smallest for this on the cassette that you can get.
If you have an 11 speed, I think it just depends. Some people still have maybe 8, 9, 10 speeds.
Oh, really? So the smallest could be an 8?
Probably 11.
11 being the smallest teeth, and it can go up to maybe 50, looks like. It depends on the bike. I don't know if this is road bike, mountain bike combination here that
I think,
the site I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Okay. So that, I hope that makes sense on why you're flattening it out, and so you definitely need something bigger than a 50 in order to not spin out at 110 RPM, especially going downhill or even on the flats.
Yeah, for sure.
And then if you want to continue, Sean, with racing, look at the course ahead of time and see what's necessary. I don't know if what the standard, I think the standard might be 53, 54.
I think that's pretty standard too. Yeah.
And then what was the other one? I think I found the site was 39. That might be the standard.
Oh, yeah. I have a 39 in front. So I have a 54-39.
Okay. That is, I think what I found. Yes. 53 or 52 is the standard chain set with the big ring. And then 39 is the inner chain ring. That's standard for the chain set. At least that's what I found on road.cc.
Yeah. And I remember when I first moved to Colorado in 1995, I had a 54-42, and I went from a 42 to a 39 so I could climb the hills.
Got it.
So it's a learning experience. I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years, but I still don't know. I don't know every answer to every bike question, especially the biking, but it's still a learning experience. It's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. This one from Kristen, and people are going to come across this at some point, most likely, the longer you are in this. She's training for a race, and it looks like an Oregon race, and she's traveling with her bike. Any tips or helpful things I should know when it comes to traveling with your bike?
You know, there's many ways you can travel with your bike. A lot of people these days use a company called like Pro Velo or Tri Bike Transport. That is a standard fee. You drop your bike off at the local bike shop near you, and it's all on their website, which local bike shop is near you where you live, a couple weeks in advance. And then they, you know, they travel around the nation picking up bikes from bike shops and taking them to races. And then when you get to the race, you just go to the tri-bike transport, which is usually at the expo of the race, and you pick your bike up. Yeah, and it's all assembled, and they don't have to do any disassembly. Sometimes you can include a gear bag for an extra fee. And, you know, you just – it seems pretty safe, pretty reliable. I've only done it once, but I prefer to fly with my bike. I have a bike – I used to have a hard bike case, mm-hmm. and now I have a soft bike case, which requires less disassembly. So I think I only have to take my pedals and my wheels off, and then my bike fits comfortably in the soft case, which I really like. I generally will always, if it's a big race like Kona or a world championship race or qualifying for Kona race that I'm going to, I will travel with my bag in to the airport. It flies with me. And then I always make an appointment with the local bike shop and have them help me make sure I put it together. You know, I don't have to put much more together, but I still make a appointment with them so they can check it out before my race. Because if I'm investing that much money into doing the race, if I'm investing money in transporting my bike to a race, I'm going to invest a little bit more money to make sure it's working properly when I get there.
Yeah, definitely. Especially if you have certain components or electronic shifting, you need to know how to take your bars off so that you don't have any issues later.
Right. And I've also, back in the day, before the, like, tri-bike transport, before those types of transport systems, when I've gone, especially in Kona, maybe not in Kona, but I've actually used like a mailing company, Federal Express, where with other companies, they federally express it to the local bike shop. And so the local bike shop gets it for an extra fee, they put it together for me, and then I just go pick it up at the local bike shop, do my race, and then I go back to the local bike shop. They disassemble it, put it in the case, and then they ship it back to me. I don't like to do that because that just takes a long time. You know, a lot of people love tri-bike transport, except it takes, you know, they're picking your bike up 2 to 3 weeks. So if that's the only bike you have, mm-hmm. you're not going to have a bike for 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And so in the past, generally, for most of my time doing triathlons, I've generally had one bike, and I didn't want to use that system because I didn't want to be without a bike for 3 weeks.
Understand.
So, yeah, there's a lot of options out there. And then when you're choosing to, if you ever were to fly with your bike, you know, something you can do is look ahead at the airline that you're flying to. They all charge different fees. Some charge $50, some charge $150. $50. Some charge $150 standard fee, plus they'll charge you for if it's over 50 pounds. And so you really kind of want to be aware on what's the best value for your buck. You know, tri-bike transport may be $300, but in the end, if you fly your bike there and back, it's going to be $300 as well. And so you got to think about the time commitment and the headache and, you know, what do you want out of the deal?
On a somewhat related but unrelated note, in your opinion, generally speaking, do you think triathletes are cheap?
No.
Like, in terms of, like, you know, I can visualize and hear in my head right now some triathletes I know complaining about prices. Like, oh, they're you know, nickel and diming me here, nickel and diming there. Oh, this costs so much. You know, all the whining that goes along with the cost of triathlon. And the sport we know is not cheap. And yet we're willing to pay, you know, thousands for a bicycle, a couple $100 for a pair of shoes every so many weeks, and so on and so on. But yet there's the moaning of, oh no, they're charging me, you know, an extra $50 than normal for my bike box.
Well, again, I think I answered the question too quickly. I think triathletes have a lot of money because the sport's expensive.
Yeah.
And I know triathletes who will sign up for 2 or 3 Ironman a year. And each Ironman costs $1,000. That's not even has to do with travel or accommodations. So I think triathletes have a lot of money, and they won't question how much money they're spending on a bike or how much they're spending on race registrations like I do. I mean, I don't necessarily have a budget, but there's a limit to how much I'm going to spend on a certain race. And there's a limit to how much I'm going to spend on a bike and any gear. I'm not necessarily a gear geek either at all, because I don't want to spend the money on it. So to answer your question, yes, there are triathletes that are cheap because, you know, but it's like anything, they pick and choose where they're going to want to spend their money.
I think maybe they just want to get a good deal. Maybe it's the personality of, you know, you already have the type A personality, but also you want to get a good deal. You know, I don't want to get screwed over. I want to get the best this, but I don't want to get screwed. Who do I know that they can get cut me a deal? I want to get sponsored. A lot of the things that young triathletes think about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I was going to go to St. George World Championship, 70.3 World Championships last year, I was asking groups and people that I know, can you get me a deal on tri-bike transport? Because I knew there were deals out there. I just didn't have access to a code. So I was the cheap athlete looking for deals, looking to save some money.
Sure.
Because I knew they were out there. But for the most part, you know, like I said, if I'm investing, you know, $1,000 to fly myself to Kona, I'm going to invest a few hundred dollars to fly my bike with me to Kona. And I'm not even going to question that.
Yeah. I don't know. Just kind of, it's humorous to me of what we're willing to spend money on and what we are willing to, what we don't want to spend money on. Right. Some people.
I will never pay full price for a wetsuit. I never have in my life. I would never do that.
They got to factor that in there, don't they? They probably know, let's jack the price up 40% and then we'll give them a 20% discount.
Right. Yeah. You know?
Because everyone wants to feel like they got a good deal, and everyone needs to make a profit, make a business. I understand that. But I also want to feel like I got something too.
Right. I agree.
That's the business of negotiating. You get something, I get something. I want to feel good about this, and you need to feel good about this.
Yep.
We both need to feel like we win.
Yep.
We covered a lot here in the 30, 40 minutes of podcasting. Anything else that pops up that you want to discuss or cover before we wrap this one up?
No, I mean, we do have a few more questions, but let's save those.
Okay, we will. And I think next week should be on schedule for a follow-up weekly program. So with that, thank you so much for listening. Have a great week of racing, training, or recovery. For Wendy Mader, I'm Dave Erickson. Have a good one. Adios.
Adios.